Hey friends, and welcome to the Moving Mountains podcast. Moving Mountains is a place to hear true stories of modern day miracles told by ordinary people just like you and me. My name is Paige, and I'm joined here in Alaska by my dear friends Margaret and Bernadette as we witness accounts of how God has worked in people's lives in big and small ways. As you listen to these stories of hope, answered prayers, and unexplained phenomena, we invite you to allow this space to inspire your faith and even to help you recognize the ways in which God is moving mountains in your own life. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Season 4 of the Moving Mountains podcast. I'm super excited to have our guests on today. My husband has been nagging me to get his buddy Tim and his friend Father Christopher on this podcast for a while, and we've finally been able to coordinate all of our time zones and schedules today. But before we introduce the two of them, I believe that Margaret has a very important question for all of us.
So, hello, everyone. We are approaching the Summer Olympics in Paris. And so my VIQ today is, if you were to participate in an Olympic sport, what would it be? So I will start while you all think about it. As a child, I 100% would have said gymnastics because I think every little girl wants to be a gymnast in the Olympics. And we would have Olympics gymnastics in our living room. So that meant we ran down the hallway. We had put cushions on the floor. And we did a flip and we stood up and, you know, did the whole little hands thing, that, and the stick your chest out thing. You guys know what I'm talking about. However, as an adult, I would have to say volleyball because I love volleyball, and watching those volleyball players do their thing on the sand court. It would be doubles volleyball outside in the sand, to be clear. It's mind-blowing, just their athleticism. So at this point in my life, volleyball. Is anyone else ready? Berna?
Yeah, I would definitely play women's soccer if I could ever be that good, which is just not in the cards, but if I could be on the Olympic soccer team, yes, please. What about you, Paige?
I think I'm similar as you, Margaret. As a kid, I definitely would have said gymnastics, but I kind of am going back and forth between swimming and track, which is funny because I hate swimming.
I thought you were going to say something Alaskan, like backcountry skiing or something.
Well, that would be the Winter Olympics.
You can't do that.
I guess I'm going to go with track, even though I'm really slow. But if I was in the Olympics, I would be really fast, which would be cool.
So are you referring to running track? Or because there's like pole vault and long jump and
one of the running events. Yeah.
Okay.
Not the field.
We'll say the steeplechase. She'll do the steeplechase.
Oh, wow. All right, Tim, your turn.
So I would have to split it up into the event I would want to do and then the event I think I'd be best at. If I could pick like my dream event, if I had the body type for it, it would be pole vault for sure.
Oh, really?
That just looks like just sailing through the air.
It looks fun. It does.
It looks fun. It's death defying. You know, all of those things appeal to me. The event that I think I'd be best at would be the javelin, because I played ball sports kind of growing up, and I could throw a ball hard.
You played
and far, so.
Did you pitch or no? Football.
I did pitch, but I played football at a small liberal arts school in Michigan, and I played quarterback, so I could throw an oblong object reasonably well. So I think
it was a D1 school, right?
It was D3, yeah.
D3, okay.
What school? Yeah. I have to ask. I grew up in Michigan.
Kalamazoo College.
Okay, right on.
Yeah.
So. Tim is very athletic. You could probably also do cycling in the Olympics, right?
Oh, I'm just too heavy. You know, like those guys that climb. I'm 6'6". You can't tell in the you know, in the video here, but I'm a tall guy. I love to cycle. I'm good in the flats. I can't climb though. I'm too heavy.
So long, pointy objects in the Olympics for Tim.
Yep. You got it.
All right, Father Chris.
You know, Tim mentioned Dream, and Dream Team jumped out in my mind.
That's perfect for you.
New school, but yeah, throw some basketball in there.
Okay.
You know, I think they're playing right now. I'm not followed too closely, but
well, they haven't officially started yet, but they're doing all this pre-Olympic stuff.
Yeah, so. the prelims, yeah, they probably like the round robin
right now. You're probably absolutely right.
Nice.
Well, thanks, guys. Yeah. I think that was
great
fun.
Question.
We
all covered like a lot of sports.
I know. I was actually
we all
surprised.
Said different sports. Yeah.
That's good.
Well, Tim, would you go ahead and jump in and introduce yourself and just let everybody know like who you are and a little bit about what you're bringing to the story?
Sure. So my name is Tim Kaselitz. I am a ICU doctor. So the technical term for that is intensivist. So I am an intensivist here in Pittsburgh, which is where the story takes place. Yeah, you'll hear a little bit more from Chris in a second, but our story centers around a medical issue and care that I was able to provide.
Thanks. Yeah, Chris, if you want to introduce yourself as well, and then you can just dive in and start sharing the story.
Yes. So Father Chris Cole, I'm no longer in Pittsburgh. I'm actually in New Jersey now, but spent nearly 3 years in Pittsburgh at a parish there, and soon after moving to the parish, which was in the neighborhood that Tim and his family live, we connected, and that really kind of ignited all this. So I will say before the start of the story, I mentioned Dream Team. Hopefully y'all can hear this. I did think about it early, but we got to play it. Y'all hear this?
Yeah.
That sounds pretty good.
So this is where the story begins.
I like
actually,
it.
Actually, it ends. Tim and I sitting on my couch 2 weeks after I'd been in the ICU and had been on ECMO for 3 or 4 days. Craziness, and we're sitting there on my couch and. I don't watch TV a lot, and I was way behind in watching The Last Dance with Jordan, that chronicles his time with the Bulls, but that was the first binge that I watched kind of post-hospital, and, Tim was like, dude, you've not watched this yet? And I'm like, sit down, and so, anyhow.
You were busy.
I've tried to really go through and make out the timeline as best as I can remember, because I think that's what makes our story just even richer. As I mentioned, we met in Pittsburgh. My wife and I moved. It was the middle of COVID, 2021. And so we move into the Highland Park neighborhood in Pittsburgh, a small Episcopal parish. It's a very charming setting with hundreds of homes all around it. Everyone talks and kind of knows everyone. And so I eventually end up meeting Tim and his family. The church had a huge lawn out front. And he had some young girls and they were there playing, in the church lawn one day, and we just struck up a conversation, and, I was new to the area, discovered he was a doctor. And I think the first, information he shared was, well, here's a doctor you should go and check out. I was trying to get all my info right. And, so that was helpful. I went and got an internist. that he knew. And so that was kind of our first big moment. And then our relationship just evolved from there. You know, we ended up talking a lot about God. I was intrigued to, you know, to find a doctor, physician, man of science, however you would want to relate or call him, who was interested in theology, right? And really pressing the various arguments that we find in the world of theology. And so we really, I think, kind of struck something there that would have been, like I say, I think in the summer of 21. And I ended up later on that year going and having my first physical. It was the first that I'd had in a long time. But that was good with a doctor that he had referred me to. Fast forward a little bit to January of 22. You know, our relationship's taken off, and Tim and his wonderful wife, Liz, they come and they say, we would love for you to baptize our youngest daughter, Vivian. And so that was a very special moment to be able to walk with them, you know, leading up to the baptism, the preparation, and just reflecting on, you know, this greater life that we are baptizing her into, and, you know, their role as parents and responsibility. You know, it was the Feast of Our Lord, January 22, baptized Vivi. And if y'all, I think one of y'all maybe have met her. I mean, she's just a rocket. I mean, just an incredible young girl, and just full of life and funny. And yeah, it was a powerful moment. I mean, it's always a powerful moment. So we, you know, that's kind of our next step.
Father Chris, did you have any sickness going on at this time? Or was it just like you were seeing a primary care physician for just routine?
Just routine. Okay. I just had moved to Pittsburgh. Like I say, I was 33, I guess. You know, still kind of living on the vapors of youth and you know, when you go to the doctor.
Invincibility.
Yeah, that's it.
He didn't even say anything to me about anything that was going on at the time. He just said, hey, do you know a doctor? I said, I know one or two. And yeah, like Father Chris said,
there was nothing going on at the time.
Right. There wasn't. You just needed a doctor. You needed a physical. I don't know if your wife was bothering you or what, but, but yeah, that's how that, that was really just as simple as that was. He said, do you have a doctor that you trust? And it was somebody I was friends with and I had done medical school with.
So. Got it.
So the baptism happens in January. In February that year, my stepfather found out he had stage 4 cancer, pancreatic cancer. And so that was, you know, kind of shook our entire family, shook me. So I had a checkup. I guess it would have been in March. Yeah, it was early Lent. I go in for a checkup, take some blood. And everything was fine, but like I just kind of had a subtle discomfort in my kind of abdomen area. I honestly thought, you know, I was probably 15 pounds overweight. I just had kind of said for a couple months, this is just being overweight. But everything was, like I say, it just happened with my stepfather. And so I pressed, you know, my internist. I said, well, let's just get this checked out, you know, got insurance. And so we're in the middle of Lent leading up to Holy Week. And so I was like, you know, let me get through Holy Week, Easter. So the scan was set for Easter Monday, of 22. And so I go in for the scan, you know, it's in the morning, like 10 o'clock, that afternoon at 3, you know, I get a call from the doc, and he's like, you know, is it that very serious voice that doctors have when it's, you know, it's time to listen up. And he's like, mm-hmm. you know, they found a, what looks to be like a tumor on your kidney. You know, I want to refer you here to an oncologist, you know, and we'll figure out kind of what directions we can go.
Yikes.
So, you know, I'm like, you know, not what you're expecting to hear it. Like I said, I was 33.
Mm-hmm. Nope.
So, I go, you know, I don't know. It's a couple of days later. I think I met up with Tim and was talking with him about it.
It was 3 weeks later.
Okay.
By the way.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the time, like I say, the time gets a little fuzzy.
It does.
You know, what I remember, that was kind of another just poignant moment is, you know, is Tim reflected, he had a brother who had kidney cancer. And so he, had a little bit of knowledge of it, you know, from that personal and in addition to the science. And so, you know, he had shared that. And so, like I say, Easter Monday, essentially what happens is 2 weeks later, I go in and have a full nephrectomy and they remove my left kidney. It's crazy. You just kind of blink an eye and think, you know, it took 2 weeks and that's where we were.
Oh my
so,
God.
yeah.
So wait, did they test the tumor or did they, we're just getting rid of the kidney?
So you can't, if I recall correctly, you can't test tumors on tumors that are on kidneys.
Okay.
You might be able
Tim can tell us.
Yeah, it's so a lot of times the treatment, and I actually wasn't, so to be clear, I know a little bit about
sure.
about Chris's particular, you know, imaging and the type of kidney cancer that he had, but the treatment for kidney renal cell carcinoma, which is what he had, is full removal of the kidney, and then they test it after. So they remove the kidney. That's definitive surgical cure, as long as it hasn't invaded into
right.
Other organs or blood vessels or things like that. Which fortunately, in Chris, it did not.
Okay,
but it's not typically very responsive, or at least historically, not very responsive to chemotherapy. We have now novel agents like immunotherapy that you can treat it with. But Chris had a very, and I don't remember your histology, but you had a very aggressive form of kidney cancer and also somewhat rare. Obviously, he's 33, so it's rare in general to have it that young. So his real treatment option was full removal of the kidney.
Makes sense. And you have another
and
one.
After
so.
They, yeah, God gives us two, thankfully. you know, it did come back that it was cancerous, you know, the tumor when they removed it. Fortunately, it was all encapsulated, so nothing spread. So, you know, it's like it's the best of the worst case scenario kind of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You know, and look, it's amazing how far we've come, you know. So here's so my mentor, was a priest, and when he was 12, he had his left kidney removed, but that was back in the day where like they slice your entire back open, to get to the kidney. Today, you know, you get a little 4-inch incision above your belly button and they take it right out through your belly button. So, I mean, science is, you know, we've come a long way. So, I mean, it's amazing to think, you know, 2 weeks, all this happens and boom. And it's like, okay, there we go. You know, and that's a certainly a traumatic trauma, to have all that. But like I say, it was and my wife reminds me all the time and describes it as the best of the worst.
Sure.
So, you know, we get through that. Like I say, that was, you know, would have been a couple weeks after Easter of 22. So we go a year now down the road. Things, you know, life's rocking and rolling. We're moving along. We were toying with walking the El Camino in Spain, you know, Christian pilgrimage.
Yep.
You know, only a bit of it, where I think if you do like 100 miles, you get a 30-year sins, you know, absolved. But I think you do the whole thing. They used to say you got all had all your sins absolved. But we're obviously going a long way back. But so we're toying with that, and I've had this like, yeah, it's sensitive. Once you kind of get cut into in your abdomen, you realize like, you know, how much you rely on your abdominal muscles, and you know, when those get cut in and just weak and trying to build that back up. And so I kept having a little discomfort, and come to find out, in one of my CT, you know, I'm having CT scans every 6 months to check on the cancer. Well, one of them reveals that I have this just teensy weensy hernia at the top of the incision point where they took my kidney out. Not a big deal. So we're thinking about this hike, and I'm talking to the oncologist, and he's like, well, yeah, you know, you just go and you get a, you know, kind of abdominal rubber thing to put around your abdomen, and you'll be fine, you know. And I'm sitting here, and, you know.
Like a binder, 30. You mean?
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Like a sleeve you put on your arm to shoot basketball, except okay. around your abdomen. And, you know, I'm like 34 at this point, and I'm like, you know, I hope that we're blessed with children one day, and, you know, I don't want to, you know, live through the rest of my life having to wear this thing around my abdomen. So I'm like, you know, I go back to Tim. I was like, what do I got to do to get this fixed? He's like, well, you know, I can refer you to a doctor. This is a pretty routine, simple surgery, outpatient deal that you can go into, and, you know, you get it cleaned up, you know, and hopefully move forward. So, you know, I'm 34, and I'm like, hold on, we got to do this, because if it's that simple, let's do it. So we set the surgery up June 24th of 23, 2 days before my wife's birthday.
2022. Yeah.
20. Oh, pardon me. 22. Thank you. So we go in that morning, you know, just having a hernia fixed. Again, it's supposed to be an outpatient surgery. Go in that morning. I don't know if I was nervous or what. You know, like I say, a year prior, I'd had an entire kidney removed. And, you know, I mean, you have it removed and you're up walking 6 hours later. Yeah, that's incredible. And so it's like, I don't know why I was nervous about having a little hernia fixed. But there was just something, I don't know. I just was not in a good headspace, I guess. And I looked at my wife and I said, okay, if anything was to happen, you know, call Mother Monty, who is really an angel in my book. She, you know, went into the Navy for a decade or two, and then she was ordained an Episcopal priest. I mean, just a holy woman.
Wow.
Who happened to have been at the parish that I was called to serve as an interim. And so mm-hmm. that's where we had met and kind of kicked things off. And so going into the hospital that morning, I'm like, hey, because we've only been in Pittsburgh like a little over a year at this point, and we didn't really know folks. And, you know, I was just thinking for Alex, like if something were to happen to me, who could she go to? And I just have Monty. So, you know, I go in. I was reflecting the other day with Tim as I was trying to put all these pieces together. I remember in pre-op, I ended up getting a student nurse. I'll say they were a student because, you know, it took like five tries to get an IV in. And dear. I've got great veins. So, you know, I was just like, okay, you know, this, hopefully she's going to learn from this. And mm-hmm. I didn't say anything, but that was kind of part of the pre-op. And then, you know, the surgery was supposed to be at 10 a.m. And I think it gets, you know, tends to be the case from what I understand in the operating room, they get backed up. And so the 10 a.m. surgery, I'm there for like 4 hours until they call me in. You know, I mean, it's just that waiting. And so I go in and, yeah, I mean, I remember, you know, being, again, I've been there a year before to have a kidney out. It was a lot more to have the kidney removed than it was to have the hernia. Just as far as preparation, signing papers and all that. But I remember being in the operating room. I remember looking at the woman who was putting me to sleep, and I was like, it's incredible because it was all women nurses and doctors. It was not a male in the room. And I was just like, what an incredible, just place to be in the world today. You know, where women are running, you know, operating rooms like that. I don't know. Forgive me. I probably always thought, you know, it's males that run the world of doctors, but no, not at all. And so that, all that happened. Great. I remember waking up in the, post-op room. You know, it was later in the afternoon, I think like somewhere 4:30, 5 o'clock, to the point that it was too late in the day to send me home. And so they chose to, admit me for the night, just, you know, I think too, if I recall, like I was experiencing a lot of pain in the aftermath. I woke up the next morning and the pain was just excruciating.
Oof.
You know, and it's, I had yet to get up.
This, it was just like totally unexpected that you were even admitted, right? Like, cause it was supposed to be a simple hernia surgery and you were supposed to be sent home the same day, but you ended up in the hospital unexpectedly just because of it being pushed later.
Yeah.
And it was more complicated too. It was a bigger hernia.
Okay.
Oh,
I don't know if you remember that piece or not, Chris, but it certainly wasn't a big deal, but Christine had said something, your surgeon said something to the effect of, you know, probably in the interim it got a little larger, so she had to do some extra reinforcement. So there, nobody was particularly surprised that pain was going to be more of an issue than it would have been, or okay. than it was expected to be with, you know, you kind of coming in and anticipating leaving. And obviously it was later on too. It was later on in the evening.
Okay.
And Tim, did you know that he was having this operation?
Yeah. So, like Father Chris said, he wanted the name of a good surgeon. So I gave him the name of somebody that I trusted.
Right.
And that I knew it was happening because I was communicating with his wife and he was communicating with me.
I see.
And I was actually rounding that week. So I was rounding in the cardiothoracic ICU that week. So, the pre-op and the post-op area, as well as the surgical waiting room, are all just down the hall from where I work.
I see. Okay.
Yeah. Right. So the next day, you know, I wake up. I've still not been able to stand up and do my walking yet, you know, which is the critical thing to getting out. My oxygen levels were also not right where they needed to be. You know, but you just kind of push through. And I remember getting up and walking at one point, you know, 4 or 5 feet, and just being like, I can't do this. I got to sit down. So I go back and lay down. And that's when I think my oxygen levels start to plummet. Now here's another interesting thing, and this is, I'll turn it over to Tim, because what was also not planned about this is he had picked up this shift just kind of out of the blue before we knew that I was going to be there, right? Mm-hmm. To where he was the attending that was responding. So when my oxygen starts to plummet, and I guess I code or whatever they would call it in doctor's terms, Tim is the one. I mean, this is a huge hospital, Trauma One Hospital, y'all. Mm-hmm. Like,
yeah.
Just the crazy. Again, he's not even supposed to be working that evening, mm-hmm. and yet he's the doctor that's on call, you know, who runs through my room.
Wow.
You know, yeah, I've talked a long time. Tim, how about you take from there?
No, I think, I think you laid the foundation down pretty well. Yeah. So like Father Chris said, that evening when he was done with his surgery, he probably doesn't remember this, but I actually spoke to his wife in the waiting room. She wasn't allowed back yet, which is pretty routine. If somebody hasn't fully waken up yet and fully recovered from the surgery, they a lot of times don't allow family back at that point. But I told her, I'm like, oh, no problem. I'll go see him. And I went back, and he was able to wake up and recognize me. Although I don't know if you remember that or not, Chris, do you remember seeing me that night?
No,
yeah, probably not. You still had the good stuff in your veins, I think. That night I actually went home. So I went to see Alex. I said, they'll let you back shortly. It sounds like they want to admit him, for pain. And it sounds like it's a little bit of a bigger hernia than what the scan showed initially. So, you know, I'll be back in the morning and I'll see him in the morning, and just check in on him. And I bet you guys will be discharged by the afternoon. So I went home, came back the next morning. Before I sat down at the computer to look at all my patients' charts, I went and visited him, and he was in a lot of pain. Again, not unexpectedly, but it was probably a little bit more pain than I would have anticipated. Alex, his wife wasn't there yet, but I had been communicating with her through text, and she was kind of on her way. So at that point, I went to go do what I do in the ICU and round and see patients and take care of patients. And all throughout that morning into the afternoon, I'd been communicating with Alex, not so much with Chris, but she had been kind of updating me like, oh, they're going to try this for pain. They actually want to keep him another night. Mm-hmm. He has a little bit of low oxygen level, so he's on some oxygen. And all that can fit with what Chris had, but it was still sort of above and beyond what you would normally expect with an uncomplicated hernia repair.
Sure.
I had then gone up to see both of them that afternoon, while they were giving him some additional medicines for pain and anxiety, and they were trying to wean him off that oxygen. And like Chris said, normally I would go home when the work was done that evening, but in this particular evening, I picked up a shift for my partner, that basically was going to require me to work through the night and then round again the next day. So it was supposed to be, you know, it was going to be like a 32, 33 hour shift or so.
Oh, man. So it's like really crazy that you happened to pick that up, because I'm sure you don't do that very often.
Yeah. Well, and actually, the way that we had set up our rules in our ICU is like we're not supposed to pick up that shift to avoid. But like I was bending the rules again to pick up the shift for a friend because he needed it for another reason. And that shift basically so I cover one ICU, but at night, and we have a bunch of different ICUs in the hospital. At night, all the attending intensivists, ICU doctors, go home, and then one stays to cover all of the ICUs of the hospital.
Yikes.
So that was good. That was gonna be me. So you pick, in other words, you pick up a pager, and then you cover all of the ICUs.
And Tim, just because for those of the listeners who don't know at this point, my husband Kyle's actually training under Tim right now. He's about to start his second year of fellowship, and he's going to be doing this CTICU ECMO track and learning from Tim over the next year. But I just wanted to also mention, like, oftentimes the attending who stays overnight isn't necessarily trained in ECMO, correct? Like, there's only a few of you who actually know what you're going to be talking about.
Right. So there's the ECMO, we'll talk a little bit about that in a second and explain it, but it's done by ICU doctors that round in the CTICU. That's exactly right, Bernie.
Okay, yeah, and so it's just kind of crazy that one, like, you happen to be on.
Right.
Okay.
Right. And so I had picked up the pager at around 5 o'clock, which is when we pick up the pager, and then again, I'd been texting with Alex. Some things have been kind of getting better. But then all of a sudden, they call a code over on the overhead pager, something we call a condition C. So that's not a full-on cardiac arrest, but what that means is that there is a patient that's decompensating. And that's one of the things that during this shift is my responsibility to respond to. And they had called it. My pager had went off. And I looked at the floor and the room number, and it just dawned on me. I'm like, oh, my God, I think this is his room and his bed number.
Oh, my gosh.
And I was actually with my fellow, so that's our trainee. So if a fellow is somebody that's done their residency and now they're subspecializing in critical care or intensive care medicine. And I looked at her and I said, I think my friend is having a big problem. And then I got a text from his wife 30 seconds after. It just said, I need you here, period. So I ran up there, and he was basically in extremis. So his oxygen levels were very dangerously low. And blood pressure was okay. So the rest of his vital signs were okay, but his oxygen was very, very low. He was on what we call 100% non-rebreather oxygen mask, where he's getting 100% supplemental oxygen to help keep his oxygen levels in an appropriate level. And it wasn't enough.
Wow.
That is crazy.
So at that point, my mind started turning. It's like, what could be causing this? He just had surgery. You know, sometimes where his hernia was kind of in the upper part of the stomach. So under rare circumstances, you can imagine that surgically you can get into the area of the lung and injure the area around the lung that can cause something called a pneumothorax, which is basically a big air pocket that squishes the lung, like the healthy lung tissue. We had thought about that. The other thing that can happen, but I didn't actually think this was likely in him, is something called a pulmonary embolism, which is a blood clot that forms in the deep veins in your legs. Typically, it can form other places, but typically the deep veins in your legs. And then it travels up to the right-sided chambers of the heart. And then the right-sided chambers of the heart pump it into the lungs. And that's a life-threatening complication. You typically see that in patients that have risk factors for developing those clots in the legs. So the classic example is if you go on an airplane ride from San Francisco to China and you're not moving your legs around and blood's just kind of stagnating in the legs, you can develop a blood clot. So that's why they tell you to do calf exercises and get up and walk around, things like that. Surgery can also be a risk factor but it's typically major surgery, and it also typically is something that happens over time, so it's not usually seen within 12 hours of the mm-hmm. surgery. My fellow at the time actually, you know, one of the other things I focus on is point of care ultrasound. And she said, well, if we're worried about a clot, why don't, you know, you're the ultrasound guy. Why don't I grab you the ultrasound and we'll take a look at his heart and see if we can find signs of a clot. And in the meantime, as we were getting that in order, his oxygen levels continued to drop. So we actually had to put that on hold. And my fellow and I put a breathing tube in Father Chris and then put him, you know, ultimately on a breathing machine because his oxygen levels are so low.
Wow.
You know, and then obviously I'm talking to Alex, his wife, going back and forth from the room. And ultimately we were able to get the ultrasound machine in the room, and that the right side of his heart, the right ventricle, which pumps blood that lacks oxygen to the lungs to receive oxygen, was big and not squeezing very well at all. Mm-hmm. It looked like it's a plumbing problem. So you can imagine if your pipes are clogged, the pipes that the pump is supposed to pump the blood into are clogged, that pump's not going to work very well. Mm-hmm. And it's actually dilated out because of all that back pressure. And that's what was happening with Chris.
Wow.
So we didn't see the clot itself, but we sent him down for a CAT scan of the lungs, and it showed a massive clot. So at that point, Chris was transferred to the ICU, and we put him on a blood thinner, and we put him on some medications to help his heart squeeze a little better. And normally that can be enough, but in his case, it wasn't. So he still continued to have issues with his oxygen levels being very low. And I was continuing to take ultrasound pictures of his heart. And actually, I have one mm-hmm. saved, and you can hear my voice in the background because it was looking bad, so bad. I said, oh my goodness, I think he needs to be put on ECMO. And then the cardiology fellow, a different physician, also a woman, I think I worked with almost all women that night too, mm-hmm. Said, yeah, I think he'll die if you don't.
Wow.
And so I should probably explain what ECMO is at this point.
Yes, I'm curious.
So ECMO stands for, it's an acronym, it stands for extracorporeal membrane oxygenation. So what it is, it's basically a heart-lung machine that we can use outside of the operating room to support somebody's lung function and blood function. I'm sorry, heart function. What it entails is inserting tubes. We call them cannulas, which are wire-reinforced tubes. You think of them like hoses. They're about the diameter of your pinky and your thumb. They go in his case, you can put them in different places, but in his case, one goes in the femoral vein, in the groin, and that reaches up towards, the heart, and it terminates near the heart. And then the smaller cannula gets inserted in the common femoral artery, also in the groin, on the arterial side. So what that does is you suck blood with a pump outside the body from that larger cannula that's in the vein. You pump it through an artificial lung, and then you return it to the patient's arterial circulation. So that's the part of the circulation that feeds our brain and our intestines and all of our body tissues. So you are basically bypassing sick heart and or lungs. And the important thing to know about it's, you can imagine it's one of the most technologically sophisticated, if not the most technologically sophisticated form of life support that we can offer a patient. And we often will use it as a bridge to basically stabilize the patient until we can fix the problem.
Wow.
So that was a very difficult decision to make. I did not make that decision alone. I recognized that this was a unique situation because of the personal relationship I had with Father Chris. And so I spoke to, and we often do this anyway with decisions as big as this, but I spoke to a number of different physicians, including some trusted partners. And ultimately, Chris's physiology pushed me to just do the procedure and get him on ECMO. It's a bedside procedure. It's done percutaneously, which basically means it's done with needles and wire, so it's not big incisions or anything like that. So it's something we can do at the bedside, but it's risky, and you can really cause a lot of harm, especially in dire circumstances. So it wasn't a decision that I took lightly. Ultimately, we successfully and safely put him on ECMO. And then the question became, well, how do we fix this blood clot problem? And so what you can do for that is you can do a procedure called a suction thrombectomy, where you insert another tube of similar size, actually, up into the right side of the heart through the arteries that go to the lungs, and you suck out the clot.
Jeez.
And being on ECMO actually
Wow.
allows you to do that somewhat more safely,
Oh
because
my
you have a it's like a safety net. He has his own heart and lungs, but now we have this artificial set of heart and lungs that are working to do that, which gives the operator that's performing the suction thrombectomy the freedom to do it with a little bit of added stability to the patient.
Was Alex around? Like, did she have to be in the waiting room for all this, or was she around for this stuff?
She was. So she actually, so
She went
I
to your
was,
house.
that's right. So I was communicating with my wife, Liz, at the same time. And, Liz, for her part, kind of held all the other pieces together, in a very calm, cool, and collected and loving way. So she took Alex in. And then I was communicating with Liz. And at one point, when I was making the decision to move forward with ECMO, we had Alex come in with Liz. I think I can't remember if I had a chance to speak to her before. I'm positive it was, I'm positive it was after. I think I spoke to her on the phone before, and then I spoke to her in person after you were more stable on ECMO. I
Let's
believe
though
that's
give
right.
Liz, I mean, this is a big moment here. So, and Liz tells it, I mean, you get goosebumps. So Alex is at her house. All this, is happening. And Tim says something, I think, to the extent of ECMO. Anyhow, that triggers, Liz, that's like, oh, wow, this is serious. So she's like, Alex, you need to get your stuff and we got to get in the car and go.
Thank you for listening to part one of this episode. We look forward to sharing part two with you next Wednesday. Thank you for listening to the Moving Mountains podcast. If you have a miracle story to tell, please call our hotline at 412-449-9609. And be sure to follow us on Instagram at Moving Mountains Podcast AK. We encourage you to subscribe, leave us a rating and review, and share our podcast with others. We'll see you next time.